From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The tragedy of immigrant children traveling alone. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Obama boasts that illegal crossings of the Mexican border are the lowest in 40 years, but for kids, it's the opposite story. The number of apprehensions expected this year is 60,000, 10 times more than 3 years ago. They're running from extortion, rape, and murder at home in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, with more of the same in store as they travel northward through Mexico. We'll hear what happens when they arrive in this country as the humanitarian crisis continues almost invisibly. Today's talking point, Rock the Vote in Afghanistan. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. At least 60,000 children from Central America are expected to be stopped at the U.S. border this year, trying to cross illegally and alone. We'll hear why they leave home, what terrors they encounter along the way, and their continuing struggles in this country. Today's talking point, there's a small but growing music scene from Kandahar to Kabul. We'll hear how rap music is encouraging young Afghans to participate in next month's presidential elections. First, this news update. There's a new development in the baffling disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, 4 days after it took off from Kuala Lumpur on its way to Beijing. Malaysian authorities now say that after it stopped communicating with ground controllers, it made an unscheduled turn to the west. Patrick Smith is a pilot and author of Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. Good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me back.
How do they know that after the plane stopped communicating with ground controllers, that it made this turn?
I'm not sure exactly. Apparently, the routing was tracked by a military satellite. That's the last I heard. However, the tracking took place. It really does, I think, push the whole conversation now in another direction, and it gets us away from the idea that some sort of instantaneous, catastrophic failure or a bombing or something instant occurred to bring the plane down. Apparently the plane, for one reason or another, meandered for a considerable length of time. And why that happened, I don't know. Nobody knows. And I think it's important not to speculate too broadly here, because undoubtedly what we come up with is going to be probably incomplete or maybe even totally off base. We just don't know, and we have to wait for more evidence. Having said that, my own hunch, and it's just my hunch, is moving towards the idea of there having been some sort of foul play.
Foul play, you mean in the cockpit, persuading the pilot to make an unscheduled change?
A hijacking, in other words. That very well could be. Another possibility, however, is some sort of bizarre mechanical malfunction, maybe a complete loss of electrical power. How that would have happened, I don't know. It's extraordinarily unlikely, but it's at least conceivable. You know, we just need to wait and see. And I know people want answers right away. And that's just not how it happens with these things, unfortunately. It sometimes takes weeks or months before we have a good idea of what happened in an air disaster.
Many countries apparently are on the search for the plane. 40 ships, according to the White House, 22 fixed-wing aircraft. Presumably there are other kinds of searches going on as well. Do they know now better, given that it took this turn to the west, where it might be?
I would say yes, that would narrow the location somewhat, but you've still got an airplane, which in the grand scheme of the South China Sea is a tiny speck, and the ocean's very large, and so it's not terribly surprising that even with a rough idea of where the plane is, that they haven't found it yet. I mean, that's not unprecedented in these sorts of circumstances, uncommon as they are.
It's now it's thought to have gone over the Malacca Strait, which is between Malaysia and Indonesia. Is that also a very large body of water? A strait makes it sound smaller.
Well, as good as I am with geography, I need to look at my globe. I see the Strait of Malacca as a channel between the big Sumatra, the largest Indonesian island, and the peninsula where Malaysia and Singapore are. On the globe, it's a small piece of ocean, but you know, practically when you're there, it's of course quite large. So we're narrowing things down. Eventually, I can't imagine the aircraft won't be found, and we should, in time, you know, figure out most of what happened and get the story. But again, you know, these things tend to take time, and people need to step back and realize that that's the way it happens in this era of instantaneous information. You know, everybody demands an answer right away so they can move on to the next thing, and that's just not going to happen in this case.
I just wondered if it might have hit land rather than water necessarily.
That's possible. Mm-hmm. That's possible. I tend to think, however, if that happened, they would have spotted the wreckage by now, but maybe not.
What about the two passengers that used the stolen passports?
Yeah, good question. You know, I suspect that there are probably thousands of people, actually, who are traveling around the world every day on forged and stolen documents for a whole number of shady reasons. That doesn't make them terrorists or bombers, hijackers, but you never know. That is absolutely something to look at, but so are a lot of other things, which brings us back to the not wanting to speculate too broadly at this juncture with so little to go on.
Okay, so once again, then, you think that this turn makes it less likely that there was a mechanical malfunction. That seems unlikely in any case, given the nature of the plane and the few times that this particular plane has, in fact, run into this kind of trouble. Maybe it landed on the ground. Maybe it's at sea. We still don't know. There's a lot of searching going on. And you're pretty persuaded, I take it. It's going to take a long time before we know what happened.
Yeah, I mean, all of these possibilities are unlikely, but clearly one of them did happen. And another thing we're hearing, too, is that the plane's transponder signal had disappeared suddenly. That's a location and altitude signal that is tracked by air traffic control. You
know, okay, maybe there's a clue there. Patrick Smith, that's all the time we have. Cockpit Confidential, everything you need to know about air travel. Also host the website askthepilot.com. Thanks very much for being on our program. In a moment, the tragedy of immigrant children alone. On To The Point.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're only back with To The Point. Enrique's Journal is a book read in high schools and colleges about an 11-year-old boy who traveled alone from Honduras to this country to reunite with his mother. It was based on a Pulitzer Prize-winning series in the Los Angeles Times by Sonia Nazario that revealed the struggles of children in separated families. 10 years later, Nazario has updated the book, not just to follow up on Enrique, but also to shed more light on the increasing immigration of children, even as the apprehension of adults is at its lowest point in 40 years. Sonia Nazario, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Warren. Delighted to be here.
Very quickly, if you will, update what happened to Enrique.
Well, he left coming in search of his mother. There were millions of single moms who have come here from Central America, Mexico, because they can't feed their children, can't see them study past the third grade. So his mother had come from Honduras to the U.S. He set off 11 years later to come find her, and he did reunify. He had many ups and downs after reunifying with her. Many of these children have huge resentments towards their parents after leaving them for so long. And in 2011, he was apprehended by the police and was put in deportation proceedings. And he had two children at that point, or one child in the United States and another on the way, and was facing being separated now in reverse from his children, being deported back to Honduras. And luckily, that did not happen for him, but has been happening for hundreds of thousands of parents who are being deported by this administration, and many of their children are ending up in the foster care system, 5,000 of them, and being fast-tracked to adoption.
How many children are anticipated to be stopped at the border from Central America? I take it that's where they're coming from mostly now this year.
Well, some federal officials are projecting that perhaps 74,000 children will be apprehended and placed in federal custody in fiscal 2014, this year. And they are coming unlawfully, and they're coming alone without either parent. And that's up from about 6,500 that we were seeing in 2011. So 10 times the number is expected this fiscal year than in 2011. So it's been this massive surge in kids who are coming to this country alone, mostly from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and many of them, one in six of these kids is younger than 12 years of age. When I was writing about Enrique's journey here, I traveled with a 12-year-old boy who was coming to the United States. Children as young as seven were coming alone, gripping onto these tops of these freight trains. Many of these kids have no money to make this journey, so they do it the only way they can, which is gripping for dear life to the tops and sides of these freight trains that travel up the length of the country. So it's an incredibly dangerous journey, and the numbers of these kids fleeing violence in Central America, really now not only coming to reunify with a parent, but fleeing for their lives, has gone up hugely in recent years.
How does a six-year-old kid learn that the way to get north and find his or her mother is to get on top of a freight train?
Well, I think a lot of the kids making this journey are teenagers. Enrique was actually 16 when he set off on his own to come find her. And all he had was a slip of paper with his mom's phone number on it. But I think through word of mouth, they know that, this is the way to go if you don't have any money. And they go with others who have been deported and made the journey before. So through word of mouth and information that's passed on, they know that this is the way that they can get north.
What do they call the train?
They call the train El Tren de la Muerte, the train of death, because you face bandits alongside the rails. There are gangsters that control the train tops. Now the Zetas, the worst narco-trafficking cartel in Mexico, the most violent one, controls the train tops, and they prefer to kidnap. They are kidnapping 18,000 Central Americans every year, making their way north through Mexico. And they prefer children because these kids carry the number of a relative in the United States, and they can extort those relatives for money, for $3,000 to $5,000. And if you don't pay, they kill these children. And so they face gangsters and the Zetas on top of the train, corrupt cops, many of whom are extorting them or robbing them and deporting them to the southern border, and they face the train itself. They have to get on and off these trains as they're moving because they're traveling through Mexico illegally. And so many of them lose arms and limbs and their lives to these trains. It's a modern-day odyssey that these children are going on trying to reach the United States.
Sonia Nazario, again, author of Enrique's Journey, a book that has been recently updated. Eric Olson is Associate Director of the Latin American Program at the Wilson Center. He's also co-editor of the book Organized Crime in Central America, The Northern Triangle. Thank you very much for joining us.
Always glad to be with you.
What's the Northern Triangle?
Well, it's a geographic designation. It refers to generally El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, and I guess roughly forms a triangle, but it's on the northern tier of Central America, closest to Mexico.
Describe what it's like in those countries that drives these children to go through the ordeal we just heard from Sonia Nazario.
Well, I can probably best describe it by my experience in one community outside of Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras. It's a community that I've been visiting since the mid-1980s and have gone back many, many times over the years. I was just there last month meeting and talking to friends, and mostly I just go to ask them that question, what is it like here, what's life become for you? And what I learned this last time is there are now six groups, illegal groups, gangs, organized crime, who are extorting people in that community. If you own a taxi, if you drive a bus, and even if you try to sell something to supplement your meager income, selling tamales or tortillas or bubble gum or whatever, you're paying what they call taxes to these organized crime groups and gangs in those communities. And generally speaking, you have no recourse to the authorities. There may be a police officer at the corner, but really aren't willing to take on violent street gangs in these communities. So young people and the people in the community grow up surrounded by criminal activity with a government that's unable to hold anybody accountable. And they have basically two choices, one, flee, or two, join, or if not join, pay what it is they're asking of you. So people who are living in desperate poverty, living in an environment that's very violent, really don't feel they have a lot of options in that kind of a community, and are many times choosing to flee to the U.S. To find jobs, to be safe, and to buy the basic necessities of life. Some of them can't even access medicine because of the situation. So it's a dire situation, difficult, and it's part of the explanation of why so many young people are heading north.
So elaborate a bit on the north, the young people in particular. Sonny Nosario said that they are recruited by the gangs. Why is it that they're, other than the fact that you can extort their friends and parents and relatives, if in fact they have any, but beyond that, why is it that they're good to be members of the gangs? Why do they want them?
Well, if for many people in a community like that, it's a zero-sum game. You're either with us or you're with our enemy. And so people, they are suspicious of people who are trying not to be a part of any organized crime group. And so to, basically avoid conflict and avoid potential violence, young people, join because they don't have many alternatives, and participate as a method of staying alive and actually joining a group. Some of them talk about the gang as being their family. This is often something we hear in El Salvador as well. People identify with the gang group, even though it's involved in illegal activities, as their extended family, and there's some protection and identity in that. So that's part of the reason that kind of thing happens. And if you don't want to play that game, if you don't want to be involved, you have few alternatives other than to leave. And you could try it another part of the country, but oftentimes people look to be reunited with their families in the United States, where they hope things will be better.
How many of the people involved in the gangs have been deported from the United States in the first place? I understand some of the gangs, particularly in El Salvador, use the same name as gangs in here in the Los Angeles area.
Yes, some of the bigger gangs did originate in Los Angeles. The MS-13, the 18th Street Gang, really those names come from gangs in Los Angeles, and they have over the years been deported in the thousands, in the tens of thousands, back to Salvador and to Honduras and Guatemala. And these gangs are most, strong, and their presence is greatest in El Salvador, but they have also spread to and have networks in Honduras and Guatemala. So part of the problem here has been the U.S.'s own deportation policy of sending gang members back to their home countries, and then there's no process, system, ability of the local receiving country to deal with them, to respond to their many needs.
And were these countries, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, badly hit by the global recession?
They all suffered enormously. First of all, they all are net importers of energy. They have very little energy sources of their own, so they're paying high prices for anything that's energy-based, petroleum-based. The export markets for their basic goods, their textiles, their assembly goods, took a nosedive, and so they've all suffered enormously. And the third thing is that all three of those economies depend quite heavily on what are called remittances, money that's sent back from their people in the United States. And many of those people in construction, in restaurant work, and hotel work lost their jobs during the recession, and remittances took a nosedive. So that impacted the economies back in these three countries as well.
Eric Olson at the Wilson Center, a co-author of Organized Crime in Central America, the Northern Triangle, talking once again about El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Honduras with the highest murder rate in the world. Sonia Nassario, back to you. What happens when the kids get to the United States?
Well, you know, many of them arrive and are not caught by Border Patrol, the majority. But if you are caught, you are put in one of more than 80 detention facilities that the U.S. government now has across 12 states just for children coming into the United States alone. And then they find a guardian or parent or someone that they can release you to, and you're ordered to go to immigration court and see if you can stay here legally or not. And the real trouble there is that, you know, these children are not entitled to a public defender. And so they are asked to go before a rogue judge and present an immigration legal case as to why they should be able to stay or not. And many of these children are quite young. I mean, I was in immigration court in L.A., and 27 children and 25 of them had no attorney to represent them because they couldn't afford a private attorney, and a public defender is not assigned to these children. And so I saw, you know, children who were very frightened and confused and fearful of being deported back to what for many of them is a very dangerous circumstance. And so that's one of the real problems with these kids, is that oftentimes they are being 40% of them, one study showed, have some avenue for relief in this country to be able to stay here legally. But very few of them are getting that because they don't have an advocate by their side to help them make that case. You know, there are toddlers, a three-year-old boy in Texas who came to court clutching his teddy bear. I mean, how can we expect a three-year-old or a five-year-old or even a 14-year-old to present a complex legal case before an immigration court? So there are these absurd circumstances that are happening in the United States today, and I think we really need the government to step up and treat children in a different way in this country.
How did the three-year-old get here?
Well, the three-year-old was found alone. He was probably abandoned by his smuggler at the border when the Border Patrol agents showed up. So some of these kids who are deemed to be alone or without an adult have really been abandoned at that last moment by their smuggler. But, you know,
why do you smuggle a three-year-old across the border?
Well, I think the parents are trying to the parents that have come here before are trying to reunify with their child, and so they pay a smuggler to bring that child north.
Okay, Sonia Nassario, Eric Olson, we'll be back with you and others as we continue this conversation in a moment. First, we need to take a very brief break. Later on, our talking point: Rock the Vote in Afghanistan. Will rap music encourage young people to participate in democracy with a lot of disinterest in next month's upcoming presidential election? We'll find out why there's that disinterest as well, and what's being done musically to try to get people out to vote. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Norman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the tragedy of immigrant children, also often traveling alone, principally from Central America now, coming up through Mexico, which is sending fewer people to this country than it has in the past, but coming up through Mexico on the tops of trains, where they face the same kind of terror that they faced at home, with gangs extorting them, attacking them physically, and in other ways abusing them, arriving then in this country, sometimes alone. We just heard about a three-year-old apparently abandoned by his smuggler at the border, trying to face an immigrant judge clutching his teddy bear. Wendy Young is president of KIND. That's Kids in Need of Defense. It's a nonprofit organization that facilitates legal representation of unaccompanied immigrant children. Wendy Young, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
What legal rights do these kids have?
Well, as Sonia said, first and foremost, they're not appointed counsel. There is no right to counsel in immigration proceedings, so they're highly dependent on pro bono or volunteer attorneys from the private sector to represent them in these incredibly complicated and challenging proceedings where they're, as Sonia said, standing before a robed immigration judge with a prosecutor from the Department of Homeland Security, typically arguing for their removal from the United States. So clearly the cards are stacked against these kids. Now, if they are represented, there are programs under U.S. immigration laws that the children may be eligible for. These include special immigrant juvenile visas for children who've been found to be abused, abandoned, or neglected, asylum for those that are found to be refugees, T visas for those that are trafficked, and various other forms of relief.
But they need legal assistance in order to assert those rights, I take it.
Absolutely. It is just surreal to see a two-year-old, that's the youngest child we've served at KIND, appear in immigration court without an attorney. There's just no way that they can argue for this kind of relief unless a lawyer is by their side to help them. And the statistics show that children who are represented are many more times likely to be deemed eligible for some relief from deportation and protection in the United States.
Did you really see a two-year-old child being brought into court and asked to face an immigrant judge?
Yes, I've actually seen a child carried into the courtroom in the arms of a deportation officer with no lawyer. And this is really a travesty of justice. It really does not stand for what the United States stands for. And these are children first, immigrants second, and we really need to meet them on their terms and provide them the kind of assistance that we would hope that any child would receive.
What kind of reaction does the immigration judge have when faced with a situation like this?
Well, to be fair, the immigration judges are actually some of the strongest advocates for appointing counsel to these children because it is very difficult for them to reach an objective, sound decision in these cases without a lawyer to help them reach that decision. So they are some of our best advocates for counsel.
Wow. How many kids are we talking about?
This year, in fiscal year 2014, the projections are that we will see as many as 60,000 to 74,000 children arrive, and that is a tenfold increase from 2011, largely due to the violence in Central America.
So let me go back quickly to Sonia Nasario. You have been with these kids in the 80 holding facilities that you described earlier. What are those like?
Well, you know, those have gotten much better than a decade ago. When I was looking at this, before many of these kids were put in jails with common criminals, in juvenile jails, and now they're largely put in detention facilities where, you know, they're fed well, they go to school, they basically wait for the authorities to figure out who they can release that child to. So they are much better than they were. Now that the program is under Health and Human Services, as it has been for many years, the treatment of these children is much better than it was.
Wendy Young, what kind of access do you and other attorneys working pro bono have to these facilities? Are they close by where the immigration courts are, or are they someplace else?
Sure. They tend to be clustered either along the border or in major urban areas in the United States. And this is another improvement that we've seen over time. Access for legal services programs such as the one that KIND administers has become much easier over the years. And in fact, HHS is cooperating with us in that to provide us that access, which is critical. In the old days, when we first started looking at these issues in the late 80s, these facilities were remote and they were very difficult to access. So the kids were truly left in there abandoned by themselves.
But now, if there's an attorney available, that person can at least go visit them.
Generally, yes.
How many kids has KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, been able to represent? How many of them have been allowed to stay in this country?
We've received case referrals of approximately 6,000 children, and we've trained over 6,000 attorneys among the private sector to represent them. So we're doing quite well, I would say, but as the numbers increase, of course, the rate of representation starts to slip again, so we're quite concerned about this.
Out of the 6,000 referrals, how many have been able to stay in this country?
We don't have those numbers per se. I would say, first of all, the vast majority are still here just because we opened 5 years ago, and these cases can take quite some time to adjudicate. So many of these cases are still pending. And then because the children are represented through KIND, the percentage of kids who receive some kind of status through our services is also quite high.
And when the Department of Homeland Security sends in a lawyer, as you indicate, to advocate that they be removed, sent back to their homes, what sort of arguments do they use? What kind of debates do you get into?
Well, typically what they're arguing is that this child is here undocumented, in other words, without the appropriate papers to remain, and unless they qualify for one of those forms of status that I mentioned earlier, such as asylum, there's no legal reason or possibility for the child to remain in the United States. So typically the lawyer from the Department of Homeland Security is taking that position.
So if they have to prove asylum, then how do they do it, particularly if they're very young? They might have been abused at home, but do they have documentation to show that, or what are they required to show?
Sure. Basically, you have to show that the conditions in your home country are such that the country cannot protect you, and you have to show that you personally were subject for that to that type of persecution. So it's a combination of bringing to the attention of the court conditions in the home country combined with the particular conditions of the child in their home community and home.
What about a child that is young and alone? And is there some sort of cutoff age at which point, if you're 5 or 6 and you're totally alone and nobody knows where your family is, you don't have to try to come up with a lot of legal evidence, or are you still required to go through the process?
You are still required to go through the process. And one of the things that's absent in the immigration system is any consideration of what's in the best interest of that particular child. In other words, even if that child is not eligible for the very defined forms of relief under our immigration laws, should we really as a country be returning that child to their home country? And our immigration laws, unfortunately, do not provide for that consideration.
The interest of the child, a very important matter in juvenile court proceedings here in this country.
Exactly. In the immigration system, it's noticeable the absence of that standard.
Wendy Young, again, the president of KIND, Kids in Need of a Defense. Roberto Suro is with us. He's formerly director of the nonpartisan research organization, the Pew Hispanic Center. He's author of Strangers Among Us, Latino Lives in a Changing America. He's now professor of journalism at the USC Annenberg School for Communication. Good to have you back on our program.
Good to be back with you, Warren.
President Obama likes to say that the number of border crossings is down 40%. We're hearing that the number of crossings of the kind we're talking about, with young children often alone, is increasing enormously, 10 times in the last 3 years. Is this a subject, is this an element that's discussed in Washington when the question of immigration comes up?
It really hasn't been. It's been lost, I think, in the focus on an overall solution. And as a result, a lot of these particular issues have gotten much less attention than they might have otherwise.
What about the president? Has he taken a lot of heat from people who are immigration advocates because of this?
I think, the issue that all of your guests have been talking about so far really is just it's competing for space on the immigration agenda, and it has been crowded out by focus on other particular groups. The early childhood arrivals that got special consideration a couple of years ago, and highly skilled workers that are a focus of the larger reform and the broader legalization program, which, by the way, probably would not offer relief to these particular these individuals because they're so recently arrived. So it's been this phenomena has really not gotten the attention it should have, in part because the debate has been very focused on a couple of other issues.
Nobody in Congress has taken it on him or herself to advocate on behalf of these kids.
I don't know nobody, but it certainly has not risen to the spotlight. And the president himself has. There have been lots of pleadings to use executive authority to deal with a variety of different categories of people under special circumstances. These kids would be one of them. The president has said he won't take individual actions on specific cases or specific categories of people because he wants to see an overall reform first. So a lot of the measures that are on the books that could be taken to provide relief for this category of people are kind of frozen as part of this stalemate.
Wenda Young, back to you with kids in need of a defense. How do these kids and their status differ from the so-called dreamers?
It is true because they're recent arrivals. They've been more recently apprehended at the border. They don't qualify under the deferred action for other child arrivals where you have to meet a 5-year residency requirement. So they are a bit of a forgotten group, if you will. We have been working hard on Capitol Hill to try to raise attention to these children, but of course there's a lot of very complicated issues in the immigration debate, and this is a relatively small number of kids compared to the overall population that needs to be addressed in the context of comprehensive immigration reform. So, you know, certainly there is room for more to be done to protect these kids.
How many kids are actually deported back home, Wenda Young, and how do they even know where home is, and how can they tell the immigration judge where they're from?
We actually have a pilot project in Guatemala where we work with children who are being deported. It's been an unknown aspect of the immigration system in the past. We've never really known what happens to these kids when they're deported or they give up and decide to go home on their own. Typically, they're escorted back by a deportation officer from the Department of Homeland Security, and then they're left at the airports in the home country with the expectation that the home country now has responsibility for caring for these children. But obviously, these are countries with very weak, if any, child welfare systems, so the child's basically left on their own to fend for themselves. So through this project, what we are doing is identifying family that they can return to, meeting them at the airport, making sure they get back to their home and community safely, and then providing them support services to reintegrate. So, you know, deportations are affecting thousands of kids a year, and it really is a bit of a black hole in the system where we don't know what happens to most of those kids after return.
Let me go back to Eric Olson again with the Wilson Center, his book, Organized Crime in Central America, The Northern Triangle. You described going back to Honduras near Tegucigalpa to see how people were doing. Are there kids there who have been returned and been deported back to their home countries that you've run across?
Yes, absolutely. That's a very common occurrence throughout Central America and in Honduras. There's been an increase in deported children as a result of this, you know, new policy.
What are they doing? What's happening to them? And are there families in this country and they're stuck back in their home country without families?
Yes, a lot. You know, there's been such a history of this migration that's obviously picked up a lot in the last couple of years, but it's been going on for some time. And so, for instance, there are close to 2 million Salvadorans in the United States. So oftentimes these young people, children, are trying to unite with some relative, not necessarily a mother, but maybe an aunt, an uncle, a cousin, something, someone back in the United States that's going to be a base of support for them. So they have families in both countries, and if, you know, I think the example of the extremely young children is more complicated, as been pointed out. Sometimes they don't know who the family is back home. But if you're a teenager and so on, they generally have some familial connection back in their home country or in the United States. And they're left to their own devices to make those connections.
And then are they subject to the same kinds of things that they tried to flee from, the kidnappings, the extortion, the kinds of abuse that you described earlier?
Yes, absolutely. That's commonplace. And sometimes they can even be singled out more because they're coming back from the U.S. And the expectation can be that somehow they have access to money, or people will try to figure out who their relatives are in the United States and extort those relatives.
Roberto Suro, back to you, formerly with the Pew Hispanic Center, now at USC Annenberg School for Communication. You said that this doesn't seem to be an issue with regard to immigration reform. What about drug reform and the talk about changing policies with regard to that? Would that in any way, do you think, have an impact on the kind of situation we're talking about?
Well, the other there's a very much neglected agenda in terms of Central America and the collateral damage of drug trafficking more broadly. There have been lots of ideas, lots of discussion about what the U.S. could do to help Honduras and other countries that are suffering some of the damage from the ongoing drug flow to the United States. There have been lots of suggestions about cooperative law enforcement dealing with human trafficking networks, and there's been a lot of discussion about what more the United States could do in collaboration with Mexico to help patrol the border and deal with the smuggling gangs there. Central America, these other issues just have not been much of a priority for this administration. There's periodic visits to the region with some broad good intentions, but very little concrete action on this. And as we've seen, the situation has significantly worsened in a number of these countries, especially Honduras.
So Wendy Young, with Kids in Need of Defense, I suppose one reform you'd like to see is more attorneys for the kids.
Absolutely. We've had a tremendous response from attorneys among the private sector, and that should be supported by the government. And in addition, appointed counsel should be made available for those cases that volunteers aren't able to help. It's really not fair to put these kids through these very difficult proceedings that literally have life or death consequences in some cases without a lawyer.
Sonia Nassario, life and death consequences?
Yes, and you know, I think what really needs to be stressed is we must, as a country, deal with what's pushing people out of Central America. We keep trying the same three approaches to immigration to slow the flow. Border enforcement to the tune of $18 billion a year, guest worker programs, and pathways to citizenship. And this has not slowed the flow permanently, and we really need a foreign policy that helps to generate jobs and lower the violence in these four countries that send three-quarters of the folks coming here unlawfully. And, you know, I believe part of the elements of that foreign policy would be improving education for girls, which lowers birth rates, providing microloans for women so they can generate jobs, trade policies that allow more goods in from those countries, and obviously also dealing with the demand for drugs in the United States that's wreaking havoc in these countries. 80% of the cocaine is coming through Honduras, and these gangs are vying for that turf. And so we need more drug treatment programs that lessen that demand for drugs. I think if we really brought everything to bear as a foreign policy and brought every tool we had in the toolbox, we could really improve conditions in these countries so these kids don't feel like they have to make this horrendous journey and suffer in all these ways that we've described.
Sonia Nassario, author of Enrique's Journey, the story of a boy's generous, dangerous odyssey to reunite with his mother. Many thanks to you. Thanks to Eric Olson at the Wilson Center. His book, Organized Crime in Central America, The Northern Triangle. Wendy Young, president of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense. And Roberto Suro at the USC School of Journalism at the Annenberg School for Communication. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. Afghanistan's presidential elections have seen a decline in voter participation for a lot of reasons. With 70% of the population under 25, rap music is being used to encourage young people to turn out for next month's voting. We'll hear about a competition to develop an anthem for the election on To the Point.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
We're not only back with today's talking point. Here's the Afghan rapper Idris Bayan singing in Pashto about how voting is a peace flag and singing can be a sword. He's encouraging young people to take part in a musical contest. Last Wrapping in Pashto. Go to the ballot boxes without any fear. Go and exercise your voting right once again. The screaming of that innocent sick child. It's the sacrifice of that old man's wound. Teenagers, youngsters, and widows are voting for their country. That was played on Afghan radio and television in an effort to get young Afghans to participate in a contest with the ultimate goal of increasing the turnout for next month's presidential elections. Ori Friedman is global editor at The Atlantic. He's written about this. Ori, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Tell us more.
They're catchy songs, aren't they?
Yeah, pretty snappy, yeah.
Yeah. The reason I wanted to write about this is because it was such an innovative approach at a time that's crucial for Afghanistan. They're about to go to the polls in April. If successful, could mark the first transfer of power to a democratically elected president in the country's history. But the issue is that voter turnout has been declining very steadily since 2004. And the big issue is, how do you attract the youth to vote? You know, that's a big problem across countries. But in Afghanistan, young people under 25 represent 7 in 10 Afghans. And you're not only fighting against voter apathy, you're also fighting against, you know, there's a slate of candidates that are mainly warlords and government insiders. They're uninspiring. And there are threats of violence at the polls.
Let me introduce Travis Beard. He's the primary organizer of the contest to develop an anthem for Afghanistan's election. His group Sound Central puts on an arts and music festival in Afghanistan. He's talking to us from this country today. Travis Beard, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Warren. How are you doing? It's actually funny. I'm talking to you from America, even though I'm running a project remotely in Afghanistan.
Sure.
My band's on tour here, but I've got an amazing team of foreigners and Afghans in Kabul who are running this competition for us. And it's been remarkably successful so far.
Well, tell us more about that. How successful has it been? What was the reaction, for example, to the rap song we just heard?
Well, we put it out on air for about 30 days, and it was basically an invitation for anyone in the country, no matter what your tribe, your background, your ethnicity, or even your location. You can write some lyrics. We provided music, so they didn't even have to write music if they couldn't. And basically, we gave them a theme, which was participation in the elections. And we had a really amazing response from all over the country. We've been working with the Afghan music scene for about 5 or 6 years now. And we found musicians and groups that we didn't even know existed. And all of a sudden, we had these new artists coming out of the woodwork, giving us really interesting entries and, you know, basically putting their voice out there about what they think about the Afghan situation now and what people should do in regards to the election. So it's been really, really inspiring.
Do they look for musical inspiration to traditional Afghan music, or are they listening to what comes out of the West?
Well, I think it's a mix. I mean, Afghanistan really, the Afghans pride themselves on their own tradition, their own country, and, you know, their own history. So I think you never take that element out of their music. But also, I mean, the youth of today, they're locked into YouTube. They know exactly what's going on around the world, and they know about other styles of music and stuff. So, you know, they're doing a bit of everything. And what we're seeing is that there's a lot of influence of poetry in Afghanistan, so that's coming out in the lyrics. But obviously, rap seems to be one of these genres of music that just fits perfectly into any kind of, you know, country that wants to, you know, have a voice. And it's just such an easy medium to actually put lyrics to. So we're finding rap is a really powerful medium. And, I mean, we've got female rappers, we've got male rappers, we've got groups of rappers, and they're really starting to take on force. And, we built up a music scene there, which was mainly rock and hip-hop and even electronic music. And now rap is kind of taking over as the main sort of alternative music in the country, which is really exciting.
Travis Beard, again, with Sound Central, put on the Arts and Festival Music Festival in Afghanistan. Ori Friedman, back to you at The Atlantic Magazine. Tell us a little bit more about the challenge here to get people to come out and vote for warlords and government insiders and others, particularly when the Taliban is threatening to be violent.
Yeah, on Monday, the Taliban issued one of its gravest threats yet, threatening violence. And during 2009, during the election, it was one of the most violent periods since the Taliban was overthrown. So you have that. But you also have the three presidential frontrunners. Two are former foreign ministers. One's a former finance minister. One seems to be endorsed by President Karzai, the outgoing president's brother, and by the president himself. So these are not also the minimum age is 40 to even run for president of Afghanistan. These are a lot of older people who are just either unsavory or uninspiring, and that makes it very difficult to get young people to the polls.
So, Travis Beard, back to you. How, then, are your singers appealing to young people when they have such a lousy choice?
Well, I think it's a really important issue. I mean, the thing in Afghanistan is it's an old government, and I mean that in the age of the people who are actually running. And I think, you know, the future of the country is the youth, and they really want to get involved, and they are in certain sort of elements within, you know, sort of local community groups and even getting to parliament stuff. But obviously the big power brokers are our elders. But I think the youth, they have a voice, and they want to be heard, and all we're basically doing is giving them a platform. And all they want to do is basically have what we have in the West, which is, you know, freedom to vote, to wear what I want to wear, and to listen to what I want to listen to music-wise. And they're not asking for anything outrageous. They're still living within their sort of Islamic sort of policy, and no one's doing anything which is offending the religion or anything else in the country. It's just it's all about music. And I think it's really amazing that this language, music can be for the youth. It's global, and it doesn't matter if, you know, you're on a hip-hop beat or if you're on an electronic beat or if you're playing a guitar. Kids get this, and I think this is a really powerful medium that we can push out to all the provinces, all 34 provinces in Afghanistan. And as long as we get it in the right language, then they can you know, get the message.
Travis Beard, teaching rap in Afghanistan with Sound Central. Thanks to you. Thanks to Uri Friedman, the global editor at The Atlantic. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.